Hi there. I can tell that you're just about to listen to a podcast from RN, which is fantastic, but I would love to encourage you to download my program. I'm Fenella Kernebone. I host By Design. It's a show all about design and architecture and how we live in this world. You can find all the information and download the podcast as well from RN's website.
RN Online, a treasure trove of content. Explore at abc.net.au/radionational.
And welcome to a new week of Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Look, our talk back on covert and overt racism on Friday. Whoa! Generated the most extraordinary response from you. Thank you for the flood of very thoughtful emails and posts and phone messages. Clearly, the discussion hit a nerve. We're seeing a similar response, I have to say, on our Facebook page overnight to the modern dilemma we'll be talking about later in the show, the vexed issue of tough love and addiction in the family. Speaking of nerve, you need it to go clothes shopping these days, I reckon. Is it a case of retail therapy for you, or does shopping for clothes leave you in need of therapy? Do you find yourself working your way through a rack of clothes only to exit the change rooms empty-handed because nothing fits? Out of shape, debunking myths about fashion and fit. Author Mel Campbell is racing to our Melbourne studios on a bus to join us, and we'll be opening the phone lines on this one too this morning, so stay tuned for that, won't you? Coming up, looking forward to your company. And it's timely to say rest in peace, the extraordinary Mundawe Yunupingu, the wonderful frontman of Yothu Yindi and a great Indigenous leader and educator. Rest in peace, sir. A big conference, and he would have been there, I suspect, kicks off this week in Cairns on Indigenous children. It's placing children's rights at the heart of the discussion, their right to good health, access to great education, access to cultural heritage and knowledge. Big gaps on all of these fronts for Indigenous kids compared to their other peers. And strikingly, it's a pattern that has played out in other former settler societies like New Zealand and Canada. Two of the conference keynotes, very effective and tough-minded advocates, are here from those two very countries to talk specifically about what role anti-discrimination law can play in shifting children's lives. I'm interested to know. Professor Cindy Kiro is a public health researcher, newly appointed as head of school of Te Kuri Māori, that's Māori education, within the Faculty of Education at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. And also joining us is Associate Professor Cindy Blackstock. She is Executive Director from the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. Welcome to you both. The two Cindys.
Good morning, Natasha.
Cindy Blackstock, let me start with you. Tell us about this organisation you represent. What are the aims of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada?
Well, like in Australia, we know a lot of what we could do to really turn the tide for First Nations children from one of oppression and one of overrepresentation amongst dire statistics to one of hope and one of prosperity for families. And that means really endorsing community-based solutions to the problems for children. And the second is getting equitable and flexible funding. So our organization is very small. We're only 3.5 people. But
wow.
We actually have...
You're gutsy.
You got to be gutsy sometimes because sadly, you know, I find the hardest things is actually getting the system to do what it knows it could be doing better. And we, for example, have the Canadian government at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal at the moment, a body that is adjudicating whether Canada is discriminating by providing less funding for First Nations children than all other children enjoy for the child welfare system.
Cindy, tell us about that case. So this is a claim that you, all 3.5 of you, and probably a network of people, have made against the Canadian government at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. And the government's pushed back fairly mightily. So what is the claim?
The claim is that the Canadian government is providing less funding for these kids who are so needy. You had the stolen generation in Australia. We had something called residential schools that just closed in 1996. And the legacies of that have created great hardships for families. there's also the wonderful resilience of our kids.
What were they, though?
The residential schools?
Yeah.
Children between the ages of 5 and 15 were removed using force if necessary and placed into Christian-run schools where they were banned from speaking their traditional languages, banned from doing their culture, banned from talking to their families. And the goal was to eliminate Aboriginal people in Canada. And sadly, many of the children died there and were abused there, much like in Stolen Generations here in Australia. And the hardships from that whole era, which really only ended just over a decade ago, really echo forward. And we have overrepresentation of First Nations children in child welfare. In fact, 48% of all children in child welfare in Canada are First Nations children, but they're driven there by poverty, poor housing, and caregiver substance misuse, all things we could do something about. Now, the Canadian government provides less funding, and they know that because we've worked with them for years developing solutions to remedy it. They didn't do it, so we filed the complaint against them at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal.
So when you say less funding, do you mean less funding on the basis of the scale of the need?
Not only on the basis of the scale of the need, but even when you compare non-Aboriginal children who, on average, have lower levels of need, they actually get higher levels of funding. And this just makes no sense to the vast majority of Canadians. And so we filed this human rights complaint in 2007 against the Canadian government. And they've spent over $3 million trying to get it derailed on legal technicalities. But fortunately, they've been unsuccessful. And on February 25th of this year, something very historic in Canada and I believe around the world happened, whereas the Canadian government is really on trial for its treatment of the current generation of children. And the tribunal has the legal authority to make a binding determination of whether Canada is discriminating or not. But more importantly, order a remedy that's enforceable in federal court, which is, of course, what we want. We want these children to be treated in fair and equitable ways so that they have an equal chance of growing up with their families.
Just before I come to the other Cindy Blackstock, why take a legal pathway, as you have, to address what you perceive to be a funding imbalance instead of negotiating with policymakers directly?
You know, it really was filed as a last resort. We had spent well over a decade at joint tables with the federal government documenting not only the inequality but the harms to children. The federal government agreed with all that. And most importantly, we developed not one, but actually three evidence-informed solutions, and the federal government never did that.
In fact, but it's an antagonistic position that you're taking, isn't it, instead of one of partnership?
Well, it's one of where we are aligning with every Canadian who believes that all children should be treated fairly by their government. And if the government doesn't agree with that, then it finds itself on the other side of the table. What we found are the vast majority of Canadians, in fact, far in excess of well over 90%, think that what the government is doing in Canada is unfair.
Professor Cindy Kiro, what about New Zealand? Do you have a human rights tribunal along the lines of the Canadian model?
We do have a human rights tribunal and we do have a different system. I mean, there is a lot of similarities between Australia and Canada, obviously, because you've got the federal and the state or provincial governments and the way in which these interact. We've got a unitary state in New Zealand and we have a treaty-based relationship between Indigenous Māori there and the Crown, the government. But having said that, it's a hell of a tough job to actually get some more equitable outcomes. We, just like in Canada and like Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island children here, have disproportionate numbers of Māori children in care. And this is despite the fact that there are benefits such as treaty settlements and an acknowledgement even of the inherent responsibilities that, if you like, the Crown have to Māori children and to doing something, even when there are explicit commitments. It's really hard to get those outcomes changed. And I'm noting, for example, this morning I saw in the Australian paper this morning there was a reference to some recent work that showed that Aboriginal children are more likely to be in care, even though they form just under 5% of the population.
They represent nearly 30%. More than
34%.
A third.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, we have the same dynamic. There's a real similarity in patterns of Indigenous children, even though there are some real advantages in New Zealand. And, you know, I'm going to be saying something which I think is going even further. I mean, you know, when Cindy and Cindy talk, we know the evidence. It's overwhelming, the evidence. And I was Children's Commissioner for New Zealand and worked closely with your state-based commissioners here too, and also with a global network of Children's Commissioners and Ombudsmen around the world.
You were the National Children's Commissioner, so you were the sole party. I mean, also the first female and also the first Maori Children's Commissioner. Did that shape your and guide your role in an effective way?
Well, I hope so. It certainly made me, I think, outspoken over certain things. But I'll come back to that in a minute, if you don't mind, because the point that I'm making is that all of the evidence overwhelmingly talks about a couple of things that I think are really key messages that I want to get across while I'm here and part of the SNAKE conference. And that is, first of all, none of the so-called problems, you know, particularly around child protection and child welfare, are going to be solved without the active participation and leadership and ownership of Indigenous communities themselves. It simply isn't going to work. And I don't know how long we have to keep learning that lesson. Basically, we need to have Aboriginal communities involved, Aboriginal leadership involved, and actually leading the way and transforming what happens in those communities, what happens with those children. We can't continue to ignore that.
Is that happening in New Zealand to any great extent, given the centrality of the Waitangi Treaty in the development of all policy in New Zealand? Is it different there?
Well, I wish it were true that, in fact, it was central to all policy, but it's actually in two bits of legislation, and there's constant attempts to undermine it, I have to say. But there is a recognition. It is happening in pockets, so that, for example, there are two areas, in particular the health providers that grew up, which were Māori-led, owned and controlled in the 1980s and provided with separate and independent funding, which has been relatively stable. And that's allowed a couple of things to happen. It's allowed Māori ownership and governance to occur and Māori skill development. So there's a competency and capacity building among Māori communities in areas of specialism, including, for example, nursing and to some extent, a smaller extent, in medicine and so forth. But also, more importantly, it's allowed a continued focus and a resource to flow through those community-owned services. And that's hugely important if you're actually going to transform and change what happens. Now, I'm going to be even more provocative and say that actually, when I look at what they're trying to achieve there, what we're achieving, you know, particularly when we join up some of the kohanga reo or early childhood education and language centres and kura that we've got going there, which are schools, that actually this kind of integrated approach to services is essential. And what's more, this seems, if you like, for want of a better word, natural and common sense. And all of the academic and research literature supports this as an idea, that basically what we need to do is we've got an opportunity as First Nations people in Canada, as Indigenous populations here, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island populations here, and Māori in New Zealand, to actually provide a transformative, joined-up approach based upon that Indigenous leadership, which could benefit everybody. Just that is a revolutionary idea.
The joined-up approach certainly is. Let's just focus on the out-of-home care question for a moment. In New Zealand and Victoria, I gather there are moves towards Indigenous services managing the whole process of out-of-home care for Indigenous children. Is that part of what you're talking about here? Because another argument could be made that that can sometimes further perpetuate or dysfunction or entrench the dysfunction within communities when they manage it.
Yeah. There are moves afoot. It's in a joined-up approach, which we're calling whānau ora, which is this idea about family-based care and the focus on integrated joined-up services. So it is part of that idea. I have to say the government has promised a great deal, both this and previous governments. I'm not picking on any particular one. But actually, they've not actually yet delivered that, except, as I said, in some instances of funding and health and some areas of support for Māori-specific language learning in early childhood. So there is a need to actually expand that, and it would make a difference. Now, the difficulty is this. It has to be good quality services. This is true for health. This is true for early childhood education. This is true for out-of-home care. Whatever it is, there is actually an obligation to provide the best quality of service. But the key thing is that it has to be two things. It has to be, if you like, owned and governed and led by those communities to actually make a difference, because they know their communities better than anybody else. If it's actually going to change anything, it will never work otherwise. The other thing is that actually that constant, if you like, those values, that desire to actually get better equity, that desire to stay on the game, can only be if you've got that level of investment and vested interest in actually seeing good outcomes.
Let me come back to Cindy Blackstock there, from the Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. That's quite a title, Cindy.
Everybody just calls us the Caring Society.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with that plan too. I mean, you've got the battle in the Human Rights Tribunal, but you also run a number of fairly unique and gutsy campaigns on health and education and Indigenous kids in Canada. Can you give us some examples here? And what strikes me is that they are run in the name of specific individual children.
Right. And we were really inspired, by the way, of the walk across the Sydney Bridge. I remember watching that in Reconciliation.
That feels like so many generations ago.
It does. But it
political
was
generations and otherwise.
But it was a magnificent moment. And for those of us across the water, we began to think about how we weave concepts of reconciliation into our work with children. And we really understood that in order to achieve really long-term change, we needed to fundamentally shift the understanding between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Canada, and thought what a great place that is to start with the children. So we have two campaigns that you're probably talking about. One is called Shannon's Dream, named in the memory of a 15-year-old girl who in Canada, remember this is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, was attending school on a toxic waste dump contaminated by over 20,000 gallons of diesel fuel and wanted a proper school for herself. And like in child welfare, First Nations education is also significantly underfunded. So she created a YouTube video, and she just from 1,200 kilometers north of Toronto in this very remote community. And she sent it out with the hope that other children and young people would write letters to the government so that every child, as Shannon would say, school is a time for dreams and every kid deserves this. Now, what was amazing is that thousands and thousands of children have joined that effort and wrote letters to the government and marched onto Parliament Hill, and they can't understand. Like a lot of these kids, we have this big bullying campaign. I don't know if you've got that a lot in Australia. It's a very positive thing, but a lot of the kids say, well, why is the government bullying these kids? Why is it that our country is giving First Nations children less? Well, one little girl said, when we asked her about what discrimination was, she said, well, discrimination is when the government thinks that kids aren't worth the money. So that's Shannon's
dream. So you've really
dream.
Used the voices of young children, and not just used them, but consulted them very effectively in some of those national campaigns.
Well, you know, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which I know that Australia was just reviewed in front of that committee a while ago, one of its founding things is about including children in matters affecting them.
Yeah.
And we feel that's important for two reasons. One is we want to raise up a generation of First Nations and non-Aboriginal children that understand each other, respect each other's cultures, and works together to uphold fundamental values, human values. The second is we want to teach them that sadly, at least in my country of Canada, the greatest human rights violations of our time have all been perpetrated by the government. And they've all been made possible because of the silence of so many caring Canadians who didn't know how to stand on guard for those values. So we want to raise a generation of kids who know how to do it in peaceful and respectful ways that create sustainable change and a better world for all of us.
Cindy Kiro, I just want to touch very briefly and finally on the role of the National Children's Commissioner in New Zealand, because now we have a federal commissioner as well as the state-based roles. Did you feel, and the commissioner is very much there as a voice for children, did you feel though in that role that Maori children had a voice in policy in New Zealand?
Yes, I felt that they did, but it wasn't one that was widely promulgated and supported or understood. And I had to be very careful. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right, being Māori and being a woman, and it staggers me that it took four commissioners before we actually got a woman.
And I sort of didn't really mean to draw that out, actually, but it is significant in this conversation.
It is. But you know, that's all part of who we are, and we take all of ourselves to any job, but particularly a role like that, which is the statutory advocacy role. But the key point is, congratulations, by the way, Australia, on actually getting a National Children's Commissioner. And you've had some very effective state-based commissioners as well, I must say. There were some fabulous colleagues. But it's a difficult role because you have to balance out all sorts of things. And, I mean, you will be well aware, you know, you're having to maintain a relationship with government. And, you know, you're meeting with and even lobbying and trying to influence ministers. But you're also maintaining the integrity and protection of, if you like, the interests of children, particularly particularly those who can't speak and who don't have a voice, which is actually what I'm hearing Cindy Blackstock talk about, is creating a voice for those who actually are voiceless within, if you like, the powerful body politic. And that's actually the role of the Children's Commissioner, as I see it, is actually giving children a voice and actually making sure that they can't be forgotten in those decision-making processes.
As they all too easily are. Gosh, that's true. Could talk about so much. I mean, the legal, the commissioner representation, and also those campaigns where children have a voice. I can see it's going to be a very feisty and hopefully a very productive conference this week in Cairns. Thank you to you both for joining me.
Well, thank you, and thank you to Snake for inviting both of us.
Yes, thanks, Snake.
Great to have you in the country. I hope we hear more of you throughout the week. Associate Professor Cindy Blackstock, she is Executive Director of the Caring Society of Canada, and Professor Cindy Kiro, who's newly appointed Head of School of Te Kura Māori within the Faculty of Education at Victoria University in New Zealand, former Children's Commissioner in New Zealand, a very significant role. We have our own here now, a National Children's Commissioner. And you're with Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Coming up, a couple of your calls from Friday.
Imagine you're a research scientist specialising in breast cancer. You've just landed your dream job in London when...
2 weeks before we were due to leave, I went to the doctor just for a checkup, and she found a lump. That moment when they said, suspicious of malignancy, it was all off, everything just completely crashed down.
This remarkable story is part of the breast cancer feature, in which we also ask, is screening mammography harming the healthy? The Health Report with me, Joel Werner, this afternoon at 5:30.
On Friday, in response to the whole debate that's unfolded around the racial slur that Eddie Maguire uttered about Adam Goods, the Swans player, we had a really rich and nuanced discussion, I think, about racism, and you've really continued that on our Facebook page. Here are some of your calls to our listener feedback line.
Hello, this is Edith. I'm white, Anglo-Saxon, and I have the highest regard for the Aboriginal people, and I've read as much as possible and have had some dealings with Aboriginal people in my lifetime, and I feel very, very racist and find most British people totally obnoxious in their superiority, their perspective on life and everything. And you can throw a lot of Americans in there as well. Thank you very much.
Very interesting comments regarding racism. Many years ago, a lecturer of mine who was from Wales told us that racism is not always a black and white or brown and white or red and white issue, that in Wales, those on the west side of the hill were very, very frightened of those on the east side of the hill because they were different. Thank you.
I have a Chinese wife who was brought up under Mao, learnt evolution. She claims she's higher on the evolutionary scale than myself, because I have really hairy arms. I'm Jewish. How does that make me feel? Not good. She's probably right, actually. Chinese are very clever people. Anyway, thank you. Bye.
And thank you. Our listener feedback line, as ever, 0283334030. That's 0283334030. And you can get on the Life Matters web page, comment there, or our Facebook page, which is going off, I have to say, at the moment. Up next, is it you or is it the clothes?
Newspapers, radio and TV overwhelm our underpants with fear. But how do we know what fear is the right fear to fear?
Are you ready?
Listen here. Hi, I'm comedian Dan Illick, and each Friday night in June, I'll be joined by some of Australia's best comedy brains on Irrational Fear. Here.
What station?
On RN. It's a fast-paced satirical comedy show. Imagine Q&A on crack. It's recorded in front of a live audience. For free tickets, look for Irrational Fear on the RN homepage.
And so to the Faustian pact we seem to make with our self-esteem when we dare to go shopping for clothes. I've taken to blaming the clothes, not the body in them, when things don't fit, defiantly so, I have to say. And it seems that might be the way to go if journalist Mel Campbell's latest investigation is anything to go by. It's a cracker of a read, a new book called Out of Shape, Debunking Myths About Fashion and Fit. Have you had that experience of being a size 12 in one shop, only to find you're extra large at another shop down the road. Give us a call, 1300 225 76 1300, call RN. How often have you had the experience that nothing fits? How does that make you feel? Despair, rage, confusion, all of that and more besides? Does your body meet the expectations clothes manufacturers seem to have of it? What do you think about sizing today? What's been your experience of buying clothes in the modern marketplace? There's a history here too. I want to hear your best and worst stories, including perhaps wardrobe malfunction stories around size as well. 1300 225 76 or 1300 call RN. Get calling. Joining us from the Melbourne studio is Mel Campbell. Welcome, Mel.
Hello.
You've raced to be here through the Melbourne traffic, haven't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in the book, I talk about how exercise came to take over our ideas about our bodies. And honestly, I think I've done a lot of that much more normally.
I was just going to say, you've dropped about 25 sizes getting here this morning.
That would be lovely, wouldn't it?
Why did you want to write this book? It's a stock standard question. It's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess partly, of course, it was my own personal experiences, but this isn't entirely a personal book. It's also about socially the way that we look at people's bodies. We judge other people on the way that they look, and we make people feel personally responsible for the way they look and bad and failed if they haven't met these really arbitrary social standards that we set for ourselves.
Well, social standards and also clothing standards. What was really evocative for me was that you remember this wonderful joy that you had as a kid of clothes. Wearing them wasn't a chore. It was playful and it was exciting and it was creative and adventurous.
That's right, but these days people dread going into shops, they dread having to get new clothes, they'll wear the old ones until they fall apart, basically just to avoid, it's a really emotional heartache that people have to go through every time they go shopping. There's a stereotype that women love shopping and that we do it socially, we do it recreationally, and that men, on the other hand, are very strategic shoppers, they'll, you know, go straight in, go straight out.
That's
but
me.
But I think pretty much everyone has difficulties shopping, and it's not a pleasure anymore. It's a chore, which is such a shame because clothes are fantastic. And, you know, I loved dressing up when I was a kid and I'd love to recapture that same kind of joy again, but it's so hard as an adult.
Yeah, the question is, how do we do that? You make and want to make a very clear distinction between size and fit.
Yeah, so let me explain what I mean by that.
Yeah.
Fit is your relationship with your clothes. It's the space between the clothes and the body, how loose and tight they are, and it's how comfortable you feel, and it's how good you feel about yourself. That's what fit is. Now, fit is a cultural thing, and it's a personal thing and an individual thing, but size is different. Size is an industrial thing. It's a technical thing. Basically, when clothes began to be mass marketed, which I argue started for men maybe in the 1830s or something.
Yeah, that was interesting to me.
A decade,
the arrival of the mass-produced suit.
Yeah, I can get to that again, but with the rise of standardised sizing, manufacturers had this massive challenge, which was how to make clothes fit most people well enough to make them shell out their money. So they developed standardised sizing that was based on previous tailoring, but basically had a set of increments along a scale. They refer to them as being graded along a scale sizes. And the idea is that that will fit most people, but it doesn't fit everyone. There are always going to be so much variation, many variations between different bodies. And so the people who get left out, the people who are the outlier sizes, the very small sizes or the very large sizes, the people who are short or tall, or the people whose body proportions don't fit the standardised proportions along the scale, they feel like it's their fault. They confuse the fit, the way that the clothes feel with their bodies, with size, which is basically impersonal. It's not meant to make you feel bad, but the side effect is that it does.
It sure does, and we take clothing size deeply personally, as you explore in the book. Just on the whole issue of national sizing standards, Mel, a dog's breakfast.
Oh, absolutely.
Is how you describe it.
And look, actually, I don't want to put down the good work of Sizing Australia, but I interrupted you.
No, who are Sizing Australia? I mean,
It's Standards Australia.
That's Standards Australia. I mean, but even they have said Oh, look, the national sizing standard seems to be a dog's breakfast.
Yeah, so they
just describe it. Describe
it. Okay, basically, we have to go back to 1926, which is when Berlay, who were at that stage a corset manufacturer, although now they're a bra manufacturer, they decided that they were going to do their own sizing survey, and they got the University of Sydney involved, the medical school there, and across the summer of 1926 to 1927, they measured a whole lot of Australian women in factories, on beaches. They had a tent set up on Bondi Beach where people would walk in bathing suits and get measured for this study. They also went round to workplaces, all sorts of places where women could be found. And then the results became known as the Australian Census of Women's Measurements or something like that. Mm. And when it came time to put a national standard in place, Australia had actually done the first field work, but it was actually the UK that had the first standard. So in the 1940s, the US decided that they were going to have a go. Now, it was the fieldwork, I think, was done in the late 30s, early 40s, and they paid people for their participation. It was just after the Depression, so we had a lot of very thin, a lot of very poor women. There were practically no non-white women participating in this American study, and practically no old women. So it was a very young, thin, white demographic.
And it still prevails.
Yeah, so basically when it came time for Australia to put our standard in progress, in process, we plugged the American measurements along with our old 1920s measurements into basically a standard set of measurements. Now, and the other thing that's quite important, two things really. First is that clothes, fashion was very dictatorial at this time. There was sort of one trend that lasted for quite a while, and pretty much everyone wore different versions of the trend. It wasn't like today where we've got lots of fragmented styles of clothing. You can basically wear anything to your own tastes because there will be a shop that will sell that sort of stuff to you. But back in the day, there were, you know, skirt hem lengths, there were tie widths, there were shoulder widths, all sorts of things that were fashionable. And people would wear underwear, corsetry, that would mould their bodies into this favoured shape. So it really wasn't that much of a stretch to have, for instance, a standard waist size, because if you didn't have a standard waist, you would just squeeze your waist with corsetry.
Yeah, and we're seeing that with some of the shapewear that's available now, aren't we?
Yeah.
If I'm going to wear any of that stuff.
Yeah, but shapewear is really interesting because it's the kind of thing that you have to pretend that you're not wearing. Because it's shameful these days to admit that you need the help of corsetry. You're meant to be able to sculpt your body from within using diet and exercise.
And that there is another whole pressure. Hey, Mel, let's take some calls because they're coming in thick and fast. Jill in Tasmania. Hi there.
Oh, yes. Hi there, Natasha.
What's your experience with this?
Well, I thought about starting a clothing company as a plus-size woman called 9 Foot Giants.
Yeah.
Because if you buy what's laughably called plus-size clothing, which you can't get because, we're a subset of discriminated against people in Australia that's never even really addressed by the mainstream, so we're completely out of the ball game entirely. If you buy plus-size clothing, it's usually so ill-fitting it's just laughable, and so hence the 9 Foot Giants.
Yeah.
Because it's too long. The sleeves are inevitably too small, or they're at least 3 or 4 inches longer than your wrist. So, you know, there is a new subset of ill-fitting in the plus-size market that you can't even dream of as a thin person, trust me.
Great point, Mel.
Yeah, well, that's actually fascinating that you should point out the weirdness of plus sizes as well, because so many companies respond to the dilemma of having to fit a larger body by simply making all the dimensions of the sizes larger. So that's why you have the longer sleeves, the longer pants. They assume that as people get wider, they get taller as well, which, as we all know, that just isn't the case. And there are also so many different ways to be plus size. You could be plus size with really big boobs. You could be plus size with a big waist or big hips or bum. And yet it's a massive challenge for clothes manufacturers to come to terms with a really 3D problem.
Oh,
using the existing 2D
measurements. That is so me. I'm so three-dimensional.
I'm
about 6 different sizes in the one body. Maria in Queensland, hello there. You're a wardrobe therapist.
I don't even know what that is.
Yep.
Okay, a wardrobe therapist is basically somebody that can utilise what you already have in your wardrobe rather than come along and literally clean the whole lot out and go, nah, you don't know how to shop. I'm more interested in looking after people's egos and keeping them quite intact. The reality is that a lot of women don't know how to shop. That's true in some cases. But
I'm not sure that I agree with you there, Maria. You know, have a brain and you can go shopping.
Well, what you have to do is go by your... Just look at yourself and say, right, in reality, what can I wear? Because what women tend to do... No, actually, I won't say women. I say people, in men and women, is that they go back to the same habits. It's like all of a sudden you've become older, you're a diabetic, and you still go for the same food. We tend to have the same habits in shopping, and we tend to keep going for the same things.
That's because we're comfortable, surely.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And why should I have to change my entire sense of style just because I get a little bit of a middle?
Yeah, but you know...
Or a big bit of a middle, as the case may be.
Is that what that says? Well, you can still have what you want, just slightly change a few things to camouflage it so that you don't look like you're still trying to get in a size 8 when you're in reality a size 12.
All right, Maria, thanks so much for the call. Mel, I'll come back to you on that one because that raises a whole set of questions. Lara in New South Wales, you are super tall in a size 6.
I am. I'm
problems in every direction.
Yeah. I'm 6 foot tall. I'm a size 6. I try to be like the perfect, you know, I could be model shape. And yet I go to a store and there's nothing that fits. You see all these advertisements for clothes and I am what you are supposed to be. And yet when you go into a shop, there's nothing there that actually fits you.
What kind of problems do you have in terms of fit?
Number one, I think my torso is probably larger than the fit size. Mm-hmm. So although I'm tall and I'm that thin, things don't fit. So the shop assistants will say to me, oh, it looks marvellous, it looks gorgeous. And then I'll be in the change rooms and take photos of myself and send it to my friends and go, what do you think? And they're like, no. That looks really, really bad.
Yeah.
So I think that it doesn't really matter if you're the perfect size or the wrong size. I think you really need to think about what suits your body shape, exactly like the last caller just said.
Thank you very much, Lara. And then the challenge is actually finding the clothes. Donna in Victoria, hi there. You've worked in the rag trade for many years in Canada. You've got something to say about Australian clothes.
Well, I'm listening to your last two callers. I've got even more to say because I'm just absolutely astonished. First off, I know my body. I know my fit. I know what looks good on me. I don't need a therapist. What I need are some clothes. Your sizing is very different. I was listening to the part about how you created your standard sizing. I would argue that they're not standard sizing. Canada has Canada standard sizing. I was there in 2006, and I can still walk into a shop and buy stuff off the rack without even trying it on. I try everything on here. I can go anywhere from a size 14 to a size 18.
Yes, I have that experience too. Donna, thanks for that.
Absolutely wild. And I actually think that, I do think too that your large size fashions, the lady who commented on the large size fashions, I'm actually working on something in that area at the moment because it's just appalling. The sorts of things that they think that women must wear just because they're bigger is they're horrendous.
Donna, we might take your number. If you can stay on the line, we might be interested in following up there. And on the Twitter, Liz writes, if I venture out, I come to the entry of the shop, scan the walls and walk on. Op shops are much better.
Exactly.
Mel, some really potent points raised there, hey?
I wanted to say so much to each separate caller because they brought up lots of fascinating issues. I mean, a lot of people seem to demand that our standard sizing be revised so that we can solve a lot of these issues on an institutional sort of top-down basis. But many of the issues are individual, and so it's almost impossible for a standard system to come to grips with those. So I guess, if anything, I want people to come away from reading my book with the feeling that it's up to you to navigate the system yourself and to have a more forgiving approach to clothes, that you don't go, I'm a size 10, for instance, and then you get mad that the size 10s don't fit you or depressed that you have to wear a size 14. You realise that it's so arbitrary. It doesn't say anything about you. And then it's basically an individual problem, really. You can't say, let's revise the sizes. I mean, even after we got the original Australian standard, it's been revised several different times. At one stage, they had Women's Weekly magazine readers sending in their vital statistics, which made the sizing even more inaccurate, because it's well known that when people measure their own bodies, they don't get it very
they
right.
Squeeze they, themselves in a bit.
Well,
or
they consistently underestimate. They underestimate their height. They overestimate their height, but they underestimate their weight, and they underestimate their dimensions of their bodies. So that made the sizing system even worse. And over the years, there have been calls to make new data for it, to have a fresh new sizing survey. But I don't think that that's the solution at all. Instead, I think the solution is to just try and come to grips with what is already out there. Now, was it Lara who mentioned that she has the shop assistants say to her, oh, you look fabulous, you look fabulous. I had exactly that same situation. I had a little survey myself where I went into a whole bunch of shops in the Bourke Street Mall here in Melbourne, and I just said to the shop assistants, what size do you think I wear? And it was fascinating to watch contorting,
isn't it?
To find something in the shop that would fit me, even though in some of the shops I was cartoonishly unable to fit into the standard size.
They would say, you can get the pants above your knee, you know, that's about it.
They'd say, oh, well, it depends on the cut of the clothes, or some things are really stretchy, but they're trained to make sales. They're not trained to be true customer service representatives a lot of the time. And this is, I think, a retail industry problem as well as a problem for consumers, because I did another survey where I asked people to tell me about the worst experiences that they had ever had in shops. Some of the stories that people told were just heartbreaking. The way that a shop assistant is able to instantly crush your self-esteem with a thoughtless remark is unbelievable. And perhaps if the retail industry realised how awful some of these casual remarks can make people feel, they might be willing to put more resources into training staff to actually help customers work with the merchandise, not necessarily just to upsell things.
I think we're going to have to get you back on. And in fact, for an entire hour of talkback, we've really only barely scratched the surface of the book because of the various travails in getting you here today. Mel Campbell, thank you very much
for
articulating this whole issue so beautifully. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
No worries.
Mel Campbell. Her book is Out of Shape, Debunking Myths About Fashion and Fit. It's published by Affirm Press. I reckon we might follow this one up. I just want to take a quick call from Matt in Canberra. Hey, Matt.
Oh, good day, Natasha. How are you?
Hi, good. What point would you like to make here briefly?
Okay, I got my knickers in a bit of a twist about 20 years ago.
Literally, I think.
20 years ago. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they phased out the intermediate sizes in men's underwear. You used to be able to get 75, 80, 85s. Now all you can get is 80, 90, 100, which is to say 4-inch increments around the chest and around the waist.
What do you think that's about?
Which is extraordinary. I blame the economic rationalists.
Does that mean you're not fitting into your undies?
Yeah, quite literally. And it's a huge jump, 4 inches around the waist. Even 2 inches is a bit of a jump. No wonder you can't get really good fitting undies anymore. It's dreadful.
Yeah, look,
it sort of happened in the mid-90s, I think.
It's very good to hear from a bloke, too, on this issue, because often it's seen as a women's issue. Thanks, Matt. And that's Matt talking about men's underwear sizing. Please get in touch if you've got a story that relates to Matt's experience of the undies, but also women as well, across, well, any type of clothing. I mean, bras, let's not even go there. Epic. Get in touch, 02833 1430, our Facebook page, our website. Up next, Modern Dilemmas.
There's a huge issue here.
I can't. Yeah, I struggle with it, to be honest.
It's like walking a tightrope.
You might feel it's the right thing to do.
How I should say something.
There is a conflict.
I would tend to check that.
I'm muddled on this.
I really struggle with it.
And to our Monday Modern Dilemma, part of this series we bring you throughout the year, fueled by dilemmas you send to us today. It's a tough one about tough love, and I can see a very rich debate actually unfolding on our Facebook page overnight on this one. Many, many tens of posts going up and a really detailed debate. Here's what was written to us by, let's call her Troubled. My friend has an adult son who lives far from her, and the son is on a drug rehab program. He seems to have a troubled history and is unable to support himself in any way. He now phones her many times a day, requesting money to pay for some urgent need, for example, a taxi to get to the doctor's, a prescription, to buy food, to pay rent, etc. He keeps phoning repeatedly until she caves in and sends him money. Then this all is all repeated the following day for another different and just as urgent need. She is very stressed as she can't really afford to keep giving him money, but she thinks that without the money he will get into worse trouble, such as going to jail. She says circumstances make it difficult for her to visit him. Also, she has to keep this all a secret from her husband, who does not tolerate the son and strongly disapproves of giving him her money. She's also concerned that at some time in the future she may need her money for her own needs. She says she has had advice to use a tough love approach and stop sending money, or to cut him off from her life, but she can't, as she fears for his safety, and as his mother, she wants to do everything she can for him. She herself is becoming unwell from the stress of it all. What can she do to save herself and her son? Really complex situation here, as many of you have acknowledged on our Facebook page in great numbers. And joining us is psychologist and ethicist Elizabeth Shaw. Welcome, Elizabeth. And also racing in, we have the CEO of the Inspire Foundation. Welcome back, Jonathan. Nicholas.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Where do we start with this one? Jonathan, her friend sounds like she's really in a rock and a hard place here. The love of a son, but a son that is in difficulty, but is also possibly exploiting her because of a drug habit.
Yeah, do you know what? The first thing that came to mind when I read this was, when you're sitting on a plane and they tell you to apply the oxygen mask to yourself before helping someone else. And I honestly think she's applying the oxygen mask to someone else and she's losing oxygen. You can feel it in the way in which this is being told,
by the
that she's trying to do the right thing. And the paternal or the maternal intent there is incredibly intense to help her son. But unfortunately, they're both losing out, from what I could read, that she's losing oxygen, her son's losing oxygen. The relationships around her are being really tough. So I think it's less about tough love. It's actually more about understanding outcomes. How can you look after yourself while looking after someone else as well?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because Raylene on her Facebook page says, maybe instead of tough love towards a child, it would be helpful to think of a soft, warm love towards yourself.
Absolutely.
Which I thought was really ties in with what you're saying. Elizabeth, this conversation about tough love, some parents absolutely swear by it as being a lifesaver, but it makes for a very difficult compromise, doesn't it? Tell us what you think of the tough love approach.
Well, I think as a parent, you start out with the desire to show love to your child and also the desire to keep them safe. So these become core values across your parenting. And so I think at this moment there's a values clash. The addiction field would tell you, if you continue to show love and support in this way, then you're considered enabling. And yet as a parent, there is this terrible fear about how to keep your child safe. And I think when you're the calls to your parenting, that's always on that Achilles heel. If you loved me, you would help me. I'll do something worse. And so this constant refrain of how do I attend to my values around loving my children and keeping them safe, in this context where suddenly the behaviour doesn't fit anything to do with love and not a lot to do with safety. So I think there is this terrible ethical bind for a parent.
An ethical bind, that's an interesting
way. Well, I think you're being asked
that,
to do
it?
Something that goes against your own values and the values that you've persisted with since early childhood.
So where would she start, do you think? Because there are a few complexities here. Her husband doesn't want to have anything to do with the son, clearly. We don't know the full picture there. The son could actually be siphoning the money. He's a long way away. He could be siphoning the money into drug use. I mean, addiction is a manipulative beast of the person who's addicted as much as the people around them.
Mm. Well, I think a place to start is to come back to those core values of, I want to continue to love my child and I want to keep them safe. And what are the ways I can build a platform of a strategy based on those those values, because I think a lot of women, a lot of parents, the suggestion of cut-off feels like a betrayal of what they've been trying to do their whole lives. So I think that's not a place to start. I think the place to start is to look at how can I continue to enact my values in a way that feels congruent and doesn't feel like a betrayal. But it may mean that she needs to do something like continue to give money. Maybe she won't be able to tolerate giving up that, but possibly by just giving an allowance once a week, then she would feel, I've continued to be supportive, but I'm not caught up in this sort of daily manipulation. And then I can really see if my son has a reason to ring me for any other purpose or not. But
so
I think
really setting boundaries on the way in which she delivers the money. Jonathan, I think this is something that you agree with too, that there needs to be some sort of curation of her response to his calls for help, particularly around money.
Absolutely, that it is one of those things around boundaries, and I agree that the primary motivation and the primary job of any parent is to keep their child safe. One of the challenges is, what do we mean by safe when we're a four-year-old means I'm going to physically hold your hand while we're crossing the road is very different than what we mean by keeping you safe when you're a teenager and when you're an adult. Mm. So the impulse is the same. That impulse never changes. But as our children grow older, it's less about taking control of your life and more about safety barriers. And one of the challenges with safety barriers is they don't prevent death. They don't actually prevent the worst outcome. But it does mean that you say, look, I'm going to do everything I can to keep you safe within the realms of my responsibilities. And ultimately, I also have to have faith in your own decisions. And that's the dilemma that she's in.
Because you are an adult.
How do you do that is incredibly
tough. And he's a compromised
tough.
Adult. If he's got a drug addiction problem, you know, he's compromised. And that's the challenge. Jonathan, a number of people have written in saying this needs to be a family project, that her and her husband actually need to come together with him. We don't know their circumstances, so we can't necessarily project that as a solution. But what role is there for that three-way conversation and perhaps four-way with another professional involved mediating?
I think in this scenario it's critical. My probably biggest concern for her is that you can feel the other relationships in her life unravelling.
Yeah.
And so she may not be able to do, and this is the hardest thing to say, she might not actually be able to do anything about the trajectory of her son's life. And there's a level of responsibility that he has to enact in changing that trajectory. But she also has a responsibility to her own life and what are the relationships she wants to maintain. And I think the difficulty here is there is a level of what we understand from the story, deception between her and her husband, where there's a conversation that's not being had for them. So I think the core that I would say is, you know, in that example of the oxygen mask, look after yourself, make sure that you're coming to some level of compromised agreement with your partner so that no matter what the outcome occurs with your son, you have joint ownership over it, whether it be good or bad, that you don't then want a scenario where one party's blaming the other party for whatever, an outcome that could actually be beyond them both.
Yeah, some people have said just walk away. Others have said in the exact same position, actually, some really, really evocative comments on a Facebook page. Parents who have dealt with addictions in the family and haven't been able to walk away and, in fact, have got quite sick when they've made that decision. Elizabeth Shaw, this is all happening at a distance, and I wonder what place actually going to see him. Again, we don't know the situation, but that physical proximity might make.
Well, look, it definitely could make a difference, because I do think that your mind runs riot at a distance. You can't imagine what's really going on. I also think when the people local to this person are telling her to step away, she might feel very compromised because she's the only one hanging in. Mm. So I think when everybody else has taken the option to step away, she might say, well, who's left holding the baby? And so certainly at a distance, your fantasy is greater about how much trouble is going on. And certainly visiting could help, but I still think that bind of who's going to be left hanging in with him, even if his behaviour is terrible, is that a reason for every friend and family member to step away? I think it leaves somebody holding that responsibility. You often see this in families where one person, even if they're not doing anything terribly useful, feel like, well, at least I'm representing the hanging on to this boy. And that's a huge bind for her to resolve. And I don't think saying, well, I'll join the other ranks is clearly, possible for her.
But if she decided to do that, and parents do sometimes make that decision, I guess we can't make them feel guilty for making that decision.
That's right.
Because that's often what they actually have to do in order to stay alive themselves.
Look, absolutely. I think by the time you're at a point of step in or step away, things are already in a very sort of, you're funneled into such terrible possibilities. I think in some ways having a reanalysis of the whole situation, I think as soon as you're in it, either or, I'll do this or I'll do that, you're never very satisfied with your decision. Mm. And sometimes looking at all options over again would be more satisfying for her in solving this dilemma.
Jonathan Nicholas, briefly and finally to you, what about the friend watching on? Because these situations radiate outwards from the family involved or the mother and son involved, and clearly the friend is impacted too.
Absolutely. I think there's an opportunity for the friend to step in and recognise that there isn't an easy way out. And actually for everyone in this situation, it might just be a matter of hold the course. You need to make whatever decisions you need to make, but whatever happens, I'll be there for you. So at least she feels as if there's a connection to her.
Yeah.
And I think that will be really critical in the long term.
Look, thank you again. And this really adds to the listener discussion that's happening as well. And hopefully our listener will be able to read these and take some comfort and maybe take some courage to make some firm decisions that look after herself. Michael Cathcart's coming up with Books and Arts Daily. Very briefly to you,
Natasha, you remember the Choir of Hard Knocks? Well, we're back. And they're now called the Choir of Hope and Inspiration. We'll talk to their boss, Jonathan Welsh.
Oh, he's wonderful. Can't wait for that. Looking forward to your company on Life Matters. Next, coming up to the news now.
Recently on RN, you may have heard music from Mona's Winter Festival in Hobart, but wouldn't you rather be there? Two lucky RN listeners and friends could be at the Winter Festival when Hobart's waterfront comes alive with art, fire, food and music. Airfares, accommodation and tickets for 3 days and nights. It's easy. Just send us a photo of your favourite Dark Mofo Winter Feast. To enter, look for Dark Mofo on the RN homepage. Going to Van Diemen's Land.